Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
From the campus of American University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between AU's Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association's Energy and Environmental Markets and Finance Committee. This is the Hot Air Show, your resource for debate and insight on carbon and energy policy, markets, and politics. I'm your host, Chris Barrett. Today we'll be looking at the energy subsidy issue with our panel. And with that, let's kick off and let folks introduce themselves.
I'm Frank Masano, an energy specialist at Bracewell Giuliani. I've been working on these issues in all different sectors for about 15 years.
I'm Kevin Book. I'm a research analyst at Clearview Energy Partners, and I draw pictures and make up numbers to try to explain politics.
I'm Ben Schreiber. I'm a climate and energy tax analyst at Friends of the Earth, and Friends of the Earth has been working on these subsidy issues for over 15 years.
I'm Ryan Alexander. I'm president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. We have the easy-to-achieve mission of working for a responsible federal government that lives within its means and have worked on energy subsidies of all sorts for more our entire history.
Thanks, folks. I think a good way to start this debate on energy subsidies would go around the table and ask everyone, how do you define energy subsidy? What falls within the breadth and scope of the definition? And if you had to highlight one or two energy subsidy issues, expansion, reduction, adoption, elimination, that you think is highly relevant in the debate today, introduce it.
Well, I think, Chris, energy subsidies are in the eye of the beholder. I mean, that's the first principle that we're always going to have to remember. One guy's energy subsidy is one guy's investment, one guy's production need to drive and foster how we develop energy. So we always have to keep that in mind as we consider this. That being said, I think probably we know that there are several sectors that are really reliant on subsidies many times to lower the price of their production because it does cost more. And that's another thing that we're going to need to keep in mind when we're trying to level that playing field over choosing renewables over a lesser costing fossil fuel for whatever reason we're doing it. That has to be considered and understood in terms of lowering the price. Secondly, I think there's one last thing that's important. When you look at, for instance, an oil incentive that encourages production for oil that we need, that has a direct impact on the bottom line of the price, which then turns into a direct impact on a lower price for the consumer. And so when we're in this age of high gas prices and we say, oh, let's get rid of the oil subsidies, what we're really doing is undermining the opportunity for us to lower the cost of doing that high-risk production, which in turn ends up raising the cost to consumer generally, because oil companies are not going to take a loss just because of that.
Well, I think we'll get into a number of the issues you raised there further in discussion. Kevin, how would you bookend the energy subsidy definition?
In my book, Chris, a subsidy is something that changes the economics of any link of the energy value chain. And because of the wonderfully arbitrary point where we draw lines in our system of common law, really a subsidy is a fiction, because governments control resources and governments ultimately control subsidies as well. And whether you deny access or you penalize production, you encourage consumption or provide a different middle of the road, middle of the value chain offset to costs, you're still effectively doing the will of the sovereign for either the producer, consumer, or both. So part of what I think is interesting about this debate, having just said the subsidies don't exist, is that the way they exist on Capitol Hill is extremely arbitrary but very relevant. Tax subsidies are choices to not spend explicit dollars. By contrast, feed-in tariffs are explicit cash payments other countries use to encourage different types of consumption and production. We've made choices to do things that conform to our political needs, and those needs are changing. And that brings us to sort of the second interesting thing that's happening. Not only are we being harder on the whole issue of how we spend explicit or tax dollars to subsidize, but we're unwilling to do it at a time when we've built this huge thirst for subsidies from a vast range of new and emerging industries, many of which, as Frank suggested, rely on these subsidies for their economic viability. So what pays for the green agenda, and how?
Ben, what's your view?
So I would actually say we have a pretty similar idea of what a subsidy is. A subsidy is anything that shifts the playing field from one energy source to another. However, I think where we differ is that there are a whole host of choices that are being made with fossil fuel production where we are actually not making polluters pay for their pollution. So things like air pollution, like greenhouse gases, which they're emitting into our air and our water, we are actually allowing them to pollute for free and impact the public health of American citizens, and that's a massive subsidy. There are also other subsidies that, you know, we're talking about or not talking about right now. So tax subsidies, I think, you know, we're having a real robust discussion in Washington right now about whether or not tax subsidies are actually subsidies. And, you know, we're seeing this over ethanol, corn ethanol in particular. And I think there's a realization that tax subsidies are subsidies. But there are other things like loan guarantees. So we're fighting... The Department of Energy is trying to give out billions of dollars in loan guarantees for nuclear power, coal, fossil fuels. Those are subsidies, and no one's really talking about the fact that that does shift energy markets. And then a third place are export credit agencies. So we are funding fossil fuel projects overseas with loans and other aid, and that is also a massive subsidy because those projects would not be built without those government support.
Interesting. Ryan, do you see the lack of the incorporation of a social cost, the ability to freely pollute? Is that a subsidy in your mind as well?
Well, I was thinking, listening to everyone's answer, that I do a much more concrete and less theoretical answer. The way we look at subsidies for energy, I mean, absolutely, one person's subsidy is another person's investment. I don't think just because something's an investment, it's not a subsidy. What we see as subsidies are kind of direct payments from the government. Here's a check. You can use this to do something. It's market distorting. Not everybody gets the check. But frankly, if every single energy source got a check from the government to do something, it would be a subsidy. It might not be a market distorting subsidy if it was equal, but it would be a subsidy. So direct payments, tax expenditures, we absolutely see as a subsidy. It's preferential treatment in the tax code. In the energy context, there are certainly some tax expenditures like intangible drilling costs, the ability to deplete that are very energy specific. And there are others that are general business tax credits, but they disproportionately provide advantages to certain energy forms like LIFO, which is last in first out accounting. There are liability caps and kind of special treatments for liability, which is where I think the question of social costs, which I think are absolutely a subsidy. If you look at the offshore liability caps for oil production, I mean, it was $75 million. Thank you, BP, for agreeing not to be capped by that, kind of. But really, did anybody think that was going to be a sufficient number for the bonding on onshore drilling? You know, they're ridiculously low bonding rates that mean that effectively the taxpayers kind of holding on to the long-term liabilities of that production on public lands and public waters. I think there's some debate, but we would say that in most cases, mandates end up being subsidies because they're market distorting, because it's basically saying federal policy dictating things. I want to make sure. And then financing subsidies. Setting up financing mechanisms that allow people to lower their cost of capital are subsidies. It's not what the market says. I mean, the loan guarantee program, which Taxpayers for Common Sense has worked a lot with Friends of the Earth and others on, is one of those things when you explain it to other business people, they're like, wow, that's a fantastic deal. I would love to have 90% of the 100% of my capital risk covered by the government. I would love to be first in line to get my risk covered and have the government be last in line to get their risk covered. So I think that's how we define subsidies. It's all sorts of different things, and trade protections. And if you go back to one of our favorites, you know, VTEC, the Volumetric Ethanol Excise Tax Credit, it's a tax credit. It's refundable, so it becomes a check. It's on top of layers of other policies that give advantages to corn ethanol. And then, you know, kind of, yes, it's a subsidy. I think a lot of people, that's one of those things that's the least controversial. Is it a subsidy? Is it a bad subsidy? Yes. We do a lot of other things. It's wasteful. And also, part of the reason that most people thought, gosh, corn ethanol, that's a great idea, is because they thought, well, it's not that carbon intensive. It's pretty good for the environment. And it turns out it's pretty carbon intensive. It takes a lot of water. It's not that great of a product. So...
Has life cycle costs.
Has life cycle costs.
Well, let's stick with that transportation sector focus, because that's been receiving a lot of attention on Capitol Hill. We saw two sets of bills move, neither one of them successful in terms of reducing an energy tax subsidy suite for the top five big oil companies, as well as we saw bills be introduced and fail that would have provided more incentives for production. you know, in this discussion, how long does it take for an energy subsidy to be in place before removing it becomes a tax?
I think it takes as long. Awesome. I think
question.
It takes as long as they can maintain it politically. I mean, really, that's the reality. Look, the ethanol industry has been getting subsidies for a long time. First, it was a requirement in the form of RFG, reformulated gasoline. Of course, the deal, the grand deal back then in the 1990 Clean Air Act was, we'll use MTBE, which is America's most misunderstood molecule, of course. That was a gasoline
it's
additive.
Like a new slogan.
A gasoline additive that reduced.
You're not with the American Chemistry Council, are you?
We did represent the MTBE manufacturers, though.
Okay.
It was a gasoline additive that was cleaner for air, and environmentalists supported it. A lot of people supported it in its production. Well, it just so happened that it leaked out of groundwater and caused a huge liability for a lot of manufacturers. So, that grand deal then slipped to ethanol only. So not only did they have a tariff protection, not only did they have a 54-cent subsidy, they had this market that was created for them in the high ozone areas. So, my biggest problem with transportation is that nobody ever truly understands the real impact of trying to supplement the current situation, the current infrastructure. We always underestimate our ability to override the cost of the current infrastructure system and what it will take to put something new into that system. And that's a big flaw with any type of transportation-related thing that's going to, quote, get us off of oil.
Now, that sounds similar to some of the arguments that people have been making in opposition to the Natural Gas Act, the NatGas Act, where it's focused on the creation of increased infrastructure for CNG vehicles and so on, natural gas vehicles, maybe even LNG vehicles at some point in the far distant future. You have the same issue on the ethanol side too. If you look at where the industry is positioning, they're saying phase us out of the VTEC and help us work in getting more infrastructure in place to help us go.
That's because for 20 years they haven't been able to do it with the subsidy, and it's because it's been an infrastructure problem all along, where stations don't want to put branded things that they don't have responsibility for under their flag, and that's been a big problem.
Can I get a voice? 36 billion gallon a year mandate. So who needs a subsidy to produce at that point? You want the infrastructure. You don't want the subsidy. Yeah. You've already got
it's
mandate.
Like the MBTV point, because that was a mandate for an oxygenate cleaner.
And now that the MTBE is out of the picture, the only oxygenate left is really ethanol.
I don't think we have enough time if we're going to broaden subsidies to include all forms of energy policy. I would suggest actually that the things that you're discussing are certainly market distortions. Trade barriers are market distortions. In fact, subsidies may or may not be market distortions, as Ryan suggested. But the subsidies that we're talking about, I think part of what's interesting here is that the explicit payment of cash is something we only started doing for renewables as part of the Recovery Act in 2009, which is something other countries have done. The idea that you would become a profitable entity and therefore have a taxable or tax burden against which a tax credit could be used was at least in part done to eliminate the financial obligation and the appearance of pork. But it also involves this idea that you're going to become successful and have profits against which that tax credit could be used.
Mm-hmm. And in down economic times, not many people have a liability to offset.
Turns out that most of these fuels didn't really work that way, and the makers of those fuels didn't really work that way. I do think that when I testified in front of the Senate Finance Committee on eliminating the so-called subsidies for oil, some of which are subsidies, some of which are tax treatment that's fair because it's done for other things and oil's just different. The point I tried to make is that we want these subsidies most of the time because we want cheap energy. There's an underlying philosophy that as a polity we've chosen. And our elected officials know that if they go against it, they're going to have a problem. And so the question you ask, Chris, is how long before it becomes part of the way it is?
Yeah, how long before it makes it a tax increase?
Once it reaches the consumer. Once the end user price will change by removing it, then it ultimately really is a subsidy, because that's when it has a political cost.
And that's different time frames for different fuels?
It changes a lot. If you're paying upfront with a debt subsidy, it may not actually have affected consumer costs directly. It may have created a greater national debt, may have eroded the dollar, may have done a lot of bad things. But the things that the retail politics can see don't show up until it's actually reaching an end user.
I mean, I think the other thing about just the kind of how long, there was a hearing earlier this year where Secretary Chu said, they asked how long do wind and solar need subsidies, and he said about as long as oil and gas, so maybe 100 years. And if you think about some of the oil and gas subsidies having been on the books for 100 years, really? Really? We need them for 100 years? We need those things because it's a nascent industry that needs some help? It's an incredibly profitable industry. I really want an oil company to tell me that if we get rid of, even if we do the most slash and burn, getting rid of the tax-based subsidies for oil and gas, that they wouldn't be profitable anymore. That's hard to believe looking at the size of their profits.
Well, they're about tax fairness, though, too. I mean, if you do a 199 tax credit for the entire manufacturing sector, they don't want to be excluded from that,
and
because that would be unfair.
We agree with them. The 199 is a general business one. We'd say get rid of it.
The other thing you have to, and that's fair, but the other thing you have to remember, too, is these industries, you say that we've become familiar with what's happened lately. And, you know, again, we were just talking about in 1998 when my daughter was born, we were getting gas for 78 cents I got gas, right, in Georgia. And the oil price was $11 to $13 a barrel. And at that time, oil companies were not rolling in huge profits. So, you know, this is a cyclical market. Things do happen. And so, you know, part of that is that the market moves way faster than the political environment can move that changes the subsidies. And that's another thing that I think is a factor that people really don't comprehend a lot of times, that a market can be up and down and twisted around, and you could be paying $36 for oil in 5 years later be paying $113 for a barrel of oil. And that's just not reflected in the politics of the subsidy debate on Capitol Hill.
Can I just interject? The price environment makes a big difference, to that sort of that retail question where people say, God, I feel it. But I don't want to defend ethanol as a career, but I'm going to do it this once. In 2008, the insurance policy that the American voters supported in 1980 finally paid off. We had a draw on light products that was based on a really robust, if declining, economy. We had a global scarcity of light sweet crude. And had there not been ethanol, and for that matter, Canadian oil to refine at high complexity refineries, had there not been this extra buffer in our fuel supply, our way of life would have become considerably more expensive far sooner, and it would have been harder to actually just keep cars on the road. It served its purpose, and you could argue that you paid for that insurance for a long time to get that payoff. The question was, the price too high, and are you still paying too much? Now that it's there, our refineries are running at 80% capacity, partly because the other 3 or 4% that they would have been running at is replaced by ethanol.
Probably because they're shutting down refineries so that they can actually constrain the market and charge higher prices. I mean, we're actually seeing refineries. There's a refinery in Virginia that was just shut down. We're seeing, you know, a push to actually move the Canadian tar sands that you're talking about into the Gulf of Mexico so that we can actually ship it out to China and away from the United States. So there's actually a push. And I think the other thing that we need to talk about is we are actually subsidizing the infrastructure for oil, not only you know, we're talking about subsidizing infrastructure for natural gas with the Natural Gas Act, but we continue to pay billions of dollars for new roads and new road construction, which is a massive subsidy for the oil and gas infrastructure. We paid $34 billion into the Highway Trust Fund in the last several years to continue to build new roads for this infrastructure. We need to actually really move away from oil, stop subsidizing road construction, stop subsidizing...
And I mean...
What are you going to do?
We're not
everybody to take on hybrid.
That's one piece of a giant political discussion.
If you look at the going back to Frank's comment about transportation, it is a huge, huge problem. I mean, ethanol is part of what depletes the Highway Trust Fund. Goes bust every year or every other year, whenever, how often it does, in part because we're not getting gas taxes off of the portion of gas that we're buying that's ethanol. Okay, that's fine. But it's yet another liability for the taxpayers. And then there's this incredible desire to look at the problem of transportation and be like, I'm sure we can do it on the cheap. And, you know, not looking at kind of what are the costs of transit, kind of why are we paying for so many roads? Why is it possible that 13% of all transportation dollars are earmarked we'll see what happens. Right, and then we'll earmark free things. But the political machinations of how you allocate transportation funds has nothing to do with kind of energy policy. It's a little bit to do with convenience, but only convenience for individual politicians. It's a it's a very broken political system.
And I worked on for Hal Rogers and on the Appropriations Committee for many years. And I can tell you one thing. The political decisions here are made for a variety of reasons, and none of them have to do with the decisions that Ben was just talking about. I mean, clearly, there are many political decisions that are made based on local politics, based on things. Find a politician that's going to oppose a transportation bill because it creates jobs and things like that in his district, and then we can have a different debate.
It's growth, it's infrastructure. You know, the highway funds have also been one of the favorite things over the years to threaten withholding.
Well, I feel like you asked a question about that sort of ethanol and natural gas that needs to, I don't want to leave
it
behind.
And then I was going to lead into that. Now, the question was really focused on infrastructure. Right now, we have a liquid fuels infrastructure established in the country. Folks are talking about adding to that infrastructure natural gas in the transportation sector, as well as electricity, more significantly. Now, I'd be curious, do you all see it's possible to actually balance that equation? Is there a way to offset the subsidy picture where you could establish new ones for electrification, natural gas, and so on, and reduce them for the incumbent liquid fuel sector? Or are we really facing a new bevy, a new round of subsidies, a new layer of turf on the playing field?
Can we just ask the obvious question, which is why would we want to do the stupidest, most expensive thing we could do when we've got perfectly good existing infrastructure? If you look again, ethanol only worked because as bad as it was, it could work in the cars we had reasonably well.
It's liquid.
It was liquid.
Yep.
Natural gas is like beer foam to gasoline's beer. If you compress beer foam enough, after you take enough runoff, it's Memorial Day weekend, guys. I'm already getting in the spirit.
No, it's good. It's good.
Compress enough beer.
I plan to shave my foam off the top of my beer. I don't know about you, though.
But the point is that if you don't discard that foam, which used to be historically vented or flared, and you actually compress it, you probably can save and conserve beers. And if you turn out to have a surplus of foam at the bottom of your keg, you probably need infrastructure to compress and convey it. That infrastructure doesn't exist. The vehicles don't exist. It can't be dropped in. And so the price tag that's being offered here, which is a modest $5 billion over 10 years for the Nat Gas Act, far too high in an environment where things already are too expensive at $2 or $3 billion, is just the beginning.
Yeah, and I think natural gas vehicles make sense only in the context of fleet vehicles and things like that. But, you could probably do it much cheaper, and I'm not an expert on this, but you could probably do it much cheaper with electrification, to be honest, with fleet vehicles, where you can plug in on a regular basis, you can have different kinds of cars and things like that. Plus, that natural gas, again, is a valued commodity that's used to make stuff. This table right here, natural gas. Gasoline additives we talked about earlier that clean the air, natural gas. Plastics, things like that, natural gas.
Fertilizer.
All of these things have natural gas derivatives, which again, we talked a little bit about the shale in the warm up here. If the shale is real and we can really tap it as much as we think, well, maybe that price won't. But traditionally, gas prices have been super volatile when the competition for those gas prices has been most aggressive, and you don't want utilities into that sector. You don't want to force everyone else into that sector when we have all these other things that we can use to keep things to more balanced.
And to be clear, I mean, we want to protect the environment and we want to move away from oil. I mean, oil has a whole host of environmental consequences that are bad for people, human health, but natural gas isn't actually better for the environment. And so we don't want to say that we're stuck with the status quo simply because we've already invested in an oil infrastructure. However, if we're going to actually invest money in an infrastructure, which we think you should do, invest in one that's actually better for the environment and for public health. And natural gas is not clearly better for the environment or public health. And so you're investing billions of dollars for something that doesn't even get you where you want to go. Let's invest in light rail. Let's invest in public transit. Let's invest in real alternatives and not waste our money.
But again, we're running into that political problem again.
Yeah, and
I don't know how many people want light rail.
I mean, from the definitions that we started a discussion about subsidies, investment, if it's not coming from the private sector directly, sua sponte, in and of itself, do we need a subsidy package to make that happen? And I guess my question is the Friends of the Earth, I'd be curious where taxpayers comes down on this. Can we achieve those types of ends that you're talking about, taking a clear-the-deck approach? A lot of folks in this town have talked about, significantly cracking open the IRC and taking a look at this. I think probably more so than any other issue in the last several months, this is one where we're seeing the most diversity of opinions across the entire political spectrum, going off and debating. Competitive Enterprise Institute recently just said that a carbon tax might make sense in the context of some of these issues.
So did AEI.
I can tell you why.
And I'd love to hear why, Kevin, but first, I would like to hear from you guys, does that vision of the future, does getting off oil, does that mean that essentially we're going to have new subsidies? Or do you think that we could clear the deck enough so that that will be a natural alternative by the way the market resettles costs?
Yeah, and so Friends of the Earth is not a, free market group. We don't think that if you just cleared the deck, since we've already invested in a oil infrastructure basically 100 years, we've been subsidizing that industry and it's mature. If you actually just clear the deck now and expect renewables to compete with mature industries, there's no way that they're going to be able to do so. So you either need to subsidize and develop renewable energy, which does have environmental benefits and public health benefits, or you actually need to put a price, a fair price, on the externalities that the fossil fuels infrastructure and the fossil fuels industry are creating. And so if you put a proper price on sulfur, NOx, greenhouse gas emissions, that was actually high enough was a reflection of their true societal costs, then maybe you could clear the deck. But barring that, then we actually do need to invest in clean alternatives.
Ryan, do you see that same, the technological maturity, market maturity as a governor to how you would address cutting subsidies?
We would certainly start with the most mature industries and govern those subsidies first. I think we do look at it as kind of, it's a mess. Politically, these are incredibly, incredibly challenging conversations. But, I think the greatest thing that you could do for renewables would be get rid of some of the long-standing, really old fossil subsidies. And the way we've done renewable subsidies, A, I'm not totally convinced that they're effective, and B, they're kind of inconsistent, all the things that, when you hear, when I testified next to renewable folks, they're like, we need more certainty, and you need to, put our subsidy into tax law for 100 years so we know it's there. And you know what? I get that. That's right. That is an easier way to do business, and it's easier for the oil and gas businesses because they've been able to rely on some of those tax breaks. But I think a cleaner and easier way to do it would be to clear the decks, try to dismantle what we have, starting with the oldest, biggest first. I have not a single doubt that some of the more mature industries will adequately defend themselves in front of Congress.
There's no doubt that a longer-term renewable incentive would be hugely beneficial. There are two political problems with it, though. First of all, you always have to score these things, and the longer you draw them out, the more they cost in terms of budgets and budget deficits, and that's a big problem for the budget
up
cutters.
Up to 10 years.
After
10 years,
they don't. Secondly,
pigs fly up for 10
years. Yes, that's right. Secondly, frankly, politicians like having people have to come back to them every 2 years for various and sundry reasons, which I don't think I need to spell out in detail. But they love to have people coming back to them every 2 years to ask for those type of incentives again. Again, from a budget perspective, but also from their own personal perspectives. From trying to get reelected.
Campaign perspective, sure. Kevin, you were going to shed some light on what was a fascinating development recently on some of these joint commissions, working groups. I'm not sure if I got the right moniker, but these coalitions of established think tanks that have been asked to tackle some of the deficit issues.
Sure.
seems to be incongruent with past positions. Talk to us a little bit about why a carbon tax is being introduced here.
This is interesting only in the context of the fact that they said no to it for so long before they said yes. If you took out that one historical problem that if they were, say, an administrative agency or a legal process would sure. create a huge barrier, but because it's a political entity, it can shift on a dime, you actually have a reasonable point of view that's consistent with the view that they want to promote business. Mm. And the main advantage of fossil fuels from a business promotion standpoint when it comes to taxing is the same advantage that comes to government funding, the size. If you apply that tax, whether you do it by BTU or gallon consumed or mile driven, to an essentially inflexible, if not slightly upward trending, net behavior, you have a huge offset to apply to payroll taxes. So they are buying into the hope for a broader tax reform, and they're saying, not only do we know that this is going to buy us more results on the supply side, at least in their view, but they also look at energy density per dollar, and they realize that if you really have a carbon tax, there are some clear-cut winners and losers. And far be it for me to say that they receive their best donations from some of the companies that would fare better than others, but the energy density per dollar winner is the oil industry, and will win in this one, too.
Politically, is anyone in this town truly scared of Grover Norquist?
Who's that?
I would say politically people are nervous about Grover Norquist. That said, you know, I think Senator Coburn, some people have been following the Senator Coburn-Grover Norquist fight quite closely, but for those of us who haven't, you know, Grover Norquist basically asked people to say, anytime you eliminate a tax break, you need to make sure that whatever increased revenue is taken away somewhere else, so that there has to be revenue neutral. You can't get rid of tax breaks without having them be revenue neutral. Yeah. And Senator Coburn, based on VTEC, said, you know, that's kind of crazy. We know VTEC's bad. We know that, you know, we actually need some more money because we got a huge debt and some debt and, you know, an incredible deficit right now, so having a little extra revenue wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. And I think it's fairly safe to say that Senator Coburn is truly ideologically in favor of a smaller government. I don't think people question his bona fides on that. But that fight of kind of, can we be practical? Can we say, if it's a wasteful tax expenditure, we should just get rid of it? And Norquist has not backed down on that. And I think that's made some people nervous, but other people kind of thought, yeah, who elected you? Nobody.
Is this an issue where...
I think this broadens out, too, to the question of the Tea Party and its role in advocating for a more conservative approach as well. And, you know, we've already seen a round of stories now about cap and trade and conservative activists bashing Republican candidates, potential Republican candidates, over support for cap and trade. I mean, traditionally, these energy issues have not played a big role in deciding who we elect, no matter how we look at it, how us in this industry or in this interest group push our issues out. It just really doesn't matter that much. But it is interesting to see how people are starting to dance around now some of these issues and the role that conservatives play. I tend to think that the Tea Party, Jim DeMint group has been overplayed as an impact. I really do. I just don't think there's that much, and they're not that different from typical Republicans in most issues. They are in the first couple weeks that they get to town, but once this place starts to operate, they're going to see that they're going to have to figure out how the place works, and it doesn't work the way they think it works. And that inevitably, again, is the political reality that all of that's... I mean, if there was a theme to what we were talking about with all of this stuff, it's that political reality is always quite a bit different and is the driver to almost all the decisions that are made on all these things, and it's really hard to change that momentum.
People can't get away from the resource politics of their own district, no matter what ideological trend.
And they never will.
They're not going to be able to do it.
And back to, you know, what actually spurred this debate between Coburn and Grover and Norquist, the ethanol tax subsidy is just indefensible. It's $5 billion a year that we are giving to this industry to produce something that they are mandated to produce by law. And you just can't defend that when we're talking about solving our deficit and debt problems.
ELI mentioned in a recent study that looked historically that, you know, the subsidies that have gone to the biofuel sectors, ethanol and so on, have dwarfed what's been going to other renewables and such. And if you look at it historically, too, is both of them dwarfed by what's been established by in the fossil fuel sector. At the same time, though, you have a lot of the tax breaks that advantage E&P companies, the small, medium-sized producers that do a lot of the drilling, whether you're talking about oil or natural gas in this country. Those, as far as many of those companies have been concerned, were the basics of the playing field from, you know, when they got going. Do you think that this debate will be able to start to break down coalitions? So, for instance, in the oil industry, you would see the interests of the small and medium-sized producers, the folks who really need some of the incentives we're talking about to be able to go and land get the next pad going, versus the bigger global conglomerates. Do you think that subdivision is actually going to be able to occur politically?
Well, Kevin's probably a good person to talk about this too. But I mean, from my perspective of having worked for all the industries, I mean, we're starting to see this in the shale gas industry right now too, because right now it's been a bunch of wildcatters running around, and now we're hearing that the Shells and the Exxons are going to come in and they're going to fix the problem. You know, they're going to make sure that it's not a bunch of rogue operators out there. And you know, and so they said the same thing here. They said the same thing in the Gulf of Mexico, and it was I think a major that had a little problem last year. I can't remember exactly.
It's all forgotten now.
Yes, but we hear this story along, and again, you know, we talked a lot about ethanol today. The ethanol industry, for the last 8 years, we've heard the ethanol industry pushing the biofuels industry out in front of them and saying, oh yeah, just give us more subsidies because second generation biofuels are right around the corner. We put a, what was it, 16 billion gallon mandate in place that was supposed to be in place right now. And yet, you know, and frankly, I've done a lot of work for biofuels companies, second generation biofuel companies like Iogen and Blue Fire and those guys. And, you know, we couldn't get the types of things we needed in place to get these projects even up closely remote to ready. And yet, you know, the ethanol industry was back behind them saying, oh, don't worry, we'll be replaced. Corn ethanol will be replaced by second generation biofuels just around the corner. So, you know, it was the same argument that we've heard over and over and over again over the years on these things. But back to your point, we're seeing it in the shale gas industry already. It's always been that the smallest guys are the ones who get pushed out front. I remember when I was with Hal Rogers, the tobacco subsidy was one of the things that they wanted to get rid of. Dick Durbin and Linda Smith and a bunch of do-gooders, anti-smoking do-gooders, wanted to get rid of a $16 billion payment program for tobacco farmers. And of course, you know, we were able to beat that back on Capitol Hill with a smaller coalition of regional support, mostly because we put the tobacco farmer, the guy who's paying for his kid's college education because he's a tobacco farmer, out in front and pushed him out in front. The corn farmers are that foil for the ethanol industry. The smaller drillers are that foil for the drilling subsidies, and so we'll continue to see that because that is
the art of politics. That's
politically effective. That's what the art of politics, and it makes it a regional issue.
Yeah. The precedent does break though because it's a regional issue. From a balance sheet perspective, consolidation has been great for the integrated supermajors. From a political perspective, it's a disaster. If you look at what you just said, Frank, you said basically the consolidation would have been a problem if these tobacco farmers had actually all been, say, in four states or three, because you wouldn't have been able to pull together that regional coalition. And if you go back to 2006, the first of the newly acquired subsidies that was rescinded was the geological and geophysical amortization period. It was done for five companies, not by name, but by a bright line test that only five companies could pass. Are you super ranger? Here's how you find out. 500,000 barrels per day, $1 billion a year in revenues, 15% from the downstream. You, sir, are a super major, you lose. And they said, fine, take it away, we don't need it. It was before they bought, by the way, all these shale plays.
Right.
The interesting thing is that precedent coincided with a year when two Republicans, Bill Frist and Chuck Grassley, were purportedly Republicans, different times, you might say they were populists or opportunists, said, rescind LIFO, go to FIFO, create a windfall, and tax it. And if you go to 2008, Kay Bailey Hutchison, John Cornyn stood by and said, change foreign oil and gas extraction income and foreign oil royalty income treatment so they're the same. Because they want disaster relief money, and freeze 199.6% for one industry. The bright lines are being drawn. And if we look at where we are, I'd say, first of all, our view is it's inevitable the oil industry is going to give something up this year. They've given it up before, and it won't be partisan. Right now, Republicans are defending oil, but the high price, Tea Party will disappear into populist wave.
Yeah.
It will be an avalanche after the high price of oil.
I think that's more an answer to the New York election than anything else.
Mm.
I mean, you can talk about Medicare, you can talk about a bunch of issues, but the reality is there was a populist push. You know, there are political structure issues there with three candidates running, which you can always say that it was an off-year election that had the ability for people to sink a lot of money into it. There are a lot of answers to that question. But there's no doubt that similar to 2010 November, there was a populist push up in that district that was driven by a high gas price that really impacted what would be an establishment candidate.
Populism is popular.
I was about to say, I mean, I think that whatever you think about the Tea Party, kind of there is a lot of populist anger. And is it the government, is that the right target? Are big corporations the right target? Is everybody the right target? Not very clear. But people are pissed, you know, and they're just like, somebody else is making out like a bandit, and it's not me. So looking at oil and gas companies right now, they're weak politically in the sense that they are a good target. That said, they have a very strong infrastructure. Just talking about kind of the marketplace for energy industries, if you think about these coalitions, like, I would love it if each energy source kind of stood on its own 2 feet and defended themselves. If you think about the loan guarantee program, which was, you know, for new innovative energies, and, you know, a huge portion of the money is allocated for nuclear energy, which last I checked has been around for quite a long time, and lots for coal, which, granted, it's trying to evolve, but again, not a brand new energy industry. And, you know, you see the wind and solar guys going, we can take a little bit of money because you can have your $20 billion. You
well,
can
and
have
that, your $30 billion. And, you know,
and it's
again,
pathetic. If they stood on their own 2 feet, I think they'd
And how about
better.
And how about this industry? What, you know, the very promising offshore wind industry just took a huge hit yesterday when NRG said, well, we're going to not put up our Met towers off the coast in what would probably be the first wind project. We're not going to put up our Met towers because of the uncertainty over federal incentives for offshore wind. Now, you know, fortunately, one of the projects that we're working on to build a transmission backbone over there doesn't have any federal incentives. They've got the Google incentive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so again, this is an area where maybe private Good Energies, Google, Marubeni, where these private fund investors can be one of the vehicles that drives some of these projects so that we get something in the water before having the federal government to do it. And, you know, unfortunately, that's become the reality of the situation.
And I'm sure that has nothing to do with the offshore wind tiers of the Mid-Atlantic State RPSs that are developing in the ocean renewable energy certificate demand, which is, again, those states stepping out and saying, we want to lead in this area, we want the jobs in this area, and we think this is going to be a significant boost to our economy. Let's get it going.
Let me just say, too, there really is an opportunity there. It's a high-cost opportunity right now. But if you think about all the other things we're doing, we've done it before. This is not something that we've done before because we haven't had the ability to do it before. And when we put a transmission backbone out there, that's going to open up a whole opportunity for us to build more stuff further out, which can impact that high congestion area in the Mid-Atlantic region and supply power to the population areas. We thought we could do it with some terrestrial land-based wind in the Mid-Atlantic, but we just figured out that there's just not enough good areas, there's not enough land, you're going to get a lot of pushback from people who don't like the way they look and things like that, and it just wasn't enough to get it close to the population centers. You're not going to build transmission lines from the way in the Midwest to get that power where it needs to be. So really, it is a good opportunity, and this is really a big sign of trouble, unfortunately, I think. And I hope for the best, and I know that the industry is having success in New Jersey and some other places, but you know, they really have to they have some high hurdles to get over to be able to make it a powerful opportunity.
Yeah, there's no shortage of regulatory questions about the pathway to getting it done, especially when you have multiple states involved, jurisdictions.
Regulatory and financial, too.
And financial as well, certainly. I want to ask everyone to comment as we wrap up the show here. I want to, before that, though, follow up on something that Ryan said, which I thought was fascinating, which is, you know, people are pissed. You know, there's more populist momentum, regardless of where it's coming from in the political spectrum, that's been increasing. And I just like to observe, in some ways, it's like we're going back to the future. You know, go back 150 years where every city had, you know, 20 to 30 papers, where everyone could read a paper that exactly agreed with their point of view, whatever it may have been. And now we're entering an age of media where everyone can find exactly their point of view and enter their own personal, theoretical, and theological echo chamber and stay there. It's interesting in that environment where interests all have, across the board, bigger microphones, how it'll balance out. And getting back to the focus on the deficit, the focus on energy subsidies, the full playing field, and so on. Let's narrow it just to tax incentives. And I'm going to ask everyone around the table to make a prediction. How significantly is Congress going to open the IRC in this session to address these issues? Ryan, you want to start us off?
I think in this Congress it will not be a huge wholesale reform of the IRC. I think that's likely in the next Congress. So I would say they look it up, they do a bunch of hearings on a bunch of tax expenditures. I do think oil will take a hit. I don't think it'll be as big of a hit as I'd like to see.
We're in the same place. I don't see wholesale IRC reform until after the 2012 election.
I cheated because I went around this week and asked on Tuesday and Wednesday, and survey says not this Congress. As far as the what happens, I think the thing everyone's forgetting is that the preferential treatments, about which we didn't speak much besides ethanol, those are also up for grabs in the next 2 years, this year and next.
Right.
And all signs point towards possible short-term lapse with continued pork. Think of it as a U-shaped relevance curve centered around essentially December. And all of, whether it's the Windies, sorry, Frank, or the Cornies, they're all going to matter for the next election starting by January. Extenders ahead.
Do you not include the Sunnies because the ITC for solar goes out 2015, 2016?
The Sunnies remain well lit.
They don't need an extender right now.
And they also, the thing that lit them up the most is there's two, 1705 credit subsidies and the 1603 program, and neither one of those look like they're going to get through the Tea Parties. So,
I've shaken the magic eight ball, and it says ask again later. So, there's going to be incremental changes. I'm sure that everybody around this table is right that the oil industry is going to give something up, and we'll get something for it in return. And it will probably be faster permits. It will probably be some sort of timeline on permit setting. That's what we're arguing for from the shallow water and side. I think that's probably the bulk of it. Does it tee up a longer-term discussion of tax reform? I think there will always be that, and I think you'll always run into the same problems of longer-term tax reform, and those are political, political, political.
And if we wait long enough, the economy will rev back in, and then we can forget all this tax reform issue.
It's already on its way.
Then the revenues start coming, and then life gets good again.
It's already on its way, and the president will benefit.
Wait a second. So that means if I keep getting fatter and keep buying bigger suits, I'm never actually going to be unhealthy.
That's correct.
Awesome.
You got it.
That's correct. I like to operate under that theory myself. Well, thanks, everyone. On behalf of all of us involved in bringing you the Hot Air Show, thanks for listening. Looking forward to having you join us next time in the heat.